Now, if you've been paying close attention to our sacred text, the three monthly booklet, you will have noticed that the title of this evening's talk is A Life Less Ordinary. And that was my attempt, which I've now been shown up. That was my attempt to sneak a talk about singleness in without putting that in the title. My fear was that if it was there in the title, then anybody who wasn't single would think, oh, well, that's a night off for me. And anybody who was single would think, oh, I can't bear the idea of a whole talk about that. So I'm not going to show up either. So frankly, the fact that any of you are here at all, I already count as a triumph. But apart from that, there are two reasons why I chose this title. One is a board game, and the other is the Bible. So the board game first. Can I have the first slide? Has anyone ever played this board game? This is the Game of Life. Yes, a few of you. Okay, you go on to the next slide. You drive your car around this board, and you go through various life experiences, and the little peg in the car represents you. And the ordinary route is that along the way, you pick up another peg to join you in the car. That's your spouse. And then maybe along the way, you get one or two pegs in the back seats of the car. That's your children. And that's the ordinary way of proceeding according to the Game of Life. And I think that's something of a view in our kind of wider culture too. Mainstream films, fairy tales even, our cultural narratives have got that kind of happy ever after vibe going on. But the truth is, of course, that nobody is actually living an ordinary life in those terms at all. Just in terms of having that little peg in the car seat next to you. Actually, earlier this year, the Office for National Statistics found that 51% of adults in the UK were single, with an even higher proportion in London. So in Islington, which is one of the most single areas of London, 3/4 of adults are single. Before anyone goes and jumps on the overground, I've done the research and found that in SE15, this postcode, 67% of adults are single in this postcode. There's another statistic which shows that 29% of households consist of just one person, with, again, slightly more than that, 35% in London. 35% of households in London consist of just one person. Now, of course, there's lots of questions about these kind of statistics. What does single mean? That sort of thing. But if there is a cultural narrative about the ordinary life, meaning that you have a peg in the car seat alongside you, the truth is that that's not that ordinary after all. So as a church, what does that mean for us? The reality of what our culture and what our community is like, what does that mean for the way we reflect Jesus to this world, this world as it actually is? And the second reason, finally the most important one, is the Bible. Because biblically, of course, there's no such thing as the ordinary life. The Bible is full of people living lives of various states of unordinariness. Sometimes it's their choice and sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's held up in the text as admirable and sometimes it's not. And there's absolutely no formula about what the ordinary life looks like. What we're called to, and actually the only thing we can live, is a life less ordinary. So I'm going to be thinking about two things: a life of extraordinary relationships and a life of extraordinary faith. And thinking about those with a particular thought to the 51% or 29% or whatever it is of single people are in our population. The Bible is rammed with stories of extraordinary life. And we're going to read a few verses of the book of Ruth together. So if you want to start to turn to page 267. I love this book. I go back to it again and again, and it always reveals something different to me. But rather than reading the conclusion, where Boaz and Ruth's eyes have met across a grain field and they've married and all the loose ends feel tied up, I want to pick up the narrative in the complicated middle, because that's where we're all living, whether we're married or whether we're single or whatever. We're all living in the complicated middle. When I was thinking about this, I realized that if I selected this chapter without me doing this mammoth introduction first of all, there was a slightly comic risk that you might think that this chapter was my comment on the single life. And looking a few verses before, Naomi says, it is more bitter for me because the Lord's hand has gone out against me. That is absolutely not where this talk is going, so have no fear. I just wanted to pick a few verses out, as I say, from the complicated middle, where all of us live our lives, to find the lives of extraordinary relationship and extraordinary faith that God can gift us with there. So I think Cindy Maria is going to come up and read from verses 16 to 18. I'll just give you a little bit of context to say how we've got there while she's just standing here, sorry. The background is that Naomi has been widowed in a famine, and both of her daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah, have also been widowed. And so Naomi's decided to go back to her homeland. She sets off with her daughters-in-law, and it's not going to be their homeland. It'll be a strange place for them. And she's just said to them, you know what? You don't come with me. You go back home. And Orpah has kissed her and gone home, and they've made a good parting. That's been a good decision. And Naomi's then said to Ruth, you should go too. I've got nothing to offer you. I have nothing to offer you. You should go home as well. And that's when we read these three verses.
But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her.
Thank you. Thanks. So, as I say, two things: extraordinary relationships and extraordinary faith. So in this wonderful book, the big story is the story of Ruth and Naomi's friendship. And the narrative shows that this friendship brings fruit for God's people and his rule in ways that are far wider than just Ruth and Naomi. And this setup to the friendship that we've just read about, this kind of comparison with Orpah going home and that not being judged at all in the text, shows that this friendship, the friendship of Ruth and Naomi, is out of the ordinary. Ruth's commitment to Naomi that we've just read of, her friendship with Naomi, is against convention, against culture, against all expectation. What she's doing, as she says, where you go, I will go, where you stay, I will stay, is dying to herself. This is the dying to self that Jesus, Ruth's great, 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 many times grandson, Jesus, would later teach and model. A giving up of one's own priorities for another. Greater love has no one than this, that they give up their lives for their friends. What Jesus teaches and models is this: the one who gives up their life will gain it in spades. That's the beautiful paradox of Christianity. To just give up our lives is some sort of martyr-like, unhealthy self-harm. It's like giving up on ourselves. That's not what we're called to. In Christ, we see that to give up our lives in friendship, in Christ-shaped friendship, which is deep and countercultural, is to gain life if we choose to receive it from him. We can get caught into cycles of just giving up our lives and refusing to accept the life that Christ is giving up. I sometimes wonder whether that can sometimes be a pattern for some single people, always choosing to give up and not so much open-handedly receiving what God has to give. And equally, we can get caught up in cycles of always receiving or always looking to receive from somebody. What does this contribute to my life? But what we see in Ruth here is giving life and receiving it. Giving up her life for her friend Naomi, she gains a people. She gains the God of Israel. She says, your God will be my God. She becomes an ancestor to King David and ultimately to Jesus. She receives this from God with open hands. Seems like a pretty good deal. So these are friendships we are called to, whatever our life circumstance. Friendship is very highly valued in the Bible. Ruth and Naomi are only just one example. Jesus said, it's by this that all people will know that you're my disciples, if you love each other. Distinctive, countercultural, loving friendship, deep, committed friendship, will be a marker of the people of God. That's the word of Jesus. Now, this isn't supposed to be a talk about friendship, it's supposed to be a talk about singleness, but if 35% of households in this city are one person, what does that mean for us as a church to be modelling lives of extraordinary friendship? I think this is a really significant call for all of us. It's not about one demographic being friends to another, but it's about us all practising deep, countercultural friendship. Naomi and Ruth's beautiful friendship here goes through different seasons. Ruth is with Naomi in this difficult homecoming that she has. Naomi is with Ruth as she goes out into the world to work. Naomi is with Ruth when this guy Boaz comes onto the horizon. So they're both giving and being open to receive. Romantic relationships in the world's narrative can be the all in all, but that isn't a biblical story. In the Bible, there's a much richer understanding of how we're blessed by God through other people. Yes, relationships within marriage and the romantic relationships, but also relationships outside of families, with friends and strangers, with anyone who God chooses to gift us with. So the question is, will we trust in that story? Will we live it, whether we're single, whether we're married, whatever? Will we put weight into that story? Will we trust that it will carry us? Will we lean into that story? And it is a distinctive story. It is a distinctive narrative. I saw a friend who I rarely see. I saw her on Friday. She's married and she's not a Christian. And she said to me that she really misses friendship in general. She told me that she's going to Uganda next week. And she said that she realized that although her husband and kids obviously know that she's going away, she said she doesn't think that anybody who she would call a friend knows that she's going away to Uganda next week. And I think she's sort of seen that as a bit of a wake-up call, and it strikes me as heartbreaking. I don't think that's God's best for us in our relationships. So married people, or people who want to be married, or people who are planning to be married, please don't wake up one day and find that that's where you've got to. Friendships with people who are in different life situations than us, whether you're single with a married person, whether you're married with a single person, do take a little bit more intention, take a little bit more choice. They take a bit more practice. That is, it doesn't come naturally. It takes a bit more practice of listening and practice of empathy. Friendships with people whose lives are different from ours are a training ground for our godly character. So let's not miss out on what they have to give us. The reason I say all of this is not to say that if only we had better friendships, then single people wouldn't ever want anything to be different, wouldn't ever want to be married. I'm not at all saying that. It's a particular and really human desire to want to find somebody to share your life with. And in phases, that desire can be exciting and hopeful, and in other phases, that desire can be painful and disappointing. But, and I, you know, moving on a little bit, I think a network of good, committed friendships can help make dating, if that's where you're at, if that's where you want to explore your singleness, which is part of that network relationships, not the only part, and not the part where you gain your deepest love, your deepest affirmation. A network of good relationships can help release single people into good, healthy, fun dating lives, which is a good thing for us as a church, and I think something we ought to be supporting. And I think a network of good committed relationships is also healthy for marriage. If all your needs are to be met in one person, that puts a huge burden on that person to meet all your emotional needs. I'm going to tell a slightly embarrassing story to illustrate this a little bit. So I've been mainly single for a long time now, and for the vast majority of that time, that's been a real site for flourishing for me. I've really known God's gifts and goodness, even in the ups and downs of a little bit of dating. So I've been largely very, very thankful. But I have had, moments of slightly less thankfulness. And I was having one such moment several years ago now, and I was grumbling to God about it. I would love to say that I was praying, but the truth is, it was nothing nearly so spiritual as that. I was grumbling in God's general direction. And the form this grumbling took was to make a list in my journal of what I now realize was basically a list of how God, in all his might and mercy, had failed to give me what I wanted. How dare he? And the last two items on my list, this is where it gets embarrassing, these are the last two items on my list. I wrote, I want someone to write down in their diary when I'm going on a holiday. For some reason, at the time, this struck me as a ridiculously poignant thing. And the final item, I want someone to know how much I like Conditor and Cook raspberry meringues. These are Conditor and Cook raspberry meringues. They are awesome. So as you can see, I am very spiritual. And obviously I didn't tell anyone about this ridiculous list, but the following day I was talking to my dear friend and housemate, Mary, about something entirely different. And she said, "Oh, Jen, I've been meaning to ask you, when is it you're going on holiday again?" And she proceeded to get out her pen and write in her diary when I was going on holiday. A couple of days later, that same week, I had a text out of the blue from another friend of mine, Esme, who said in her text, "I am looking at a Conditor and Cook raspberry meringue and thinking of you." And I remember thinking something along the lines of, "Oh God, can't I even grumble without you hearing me?" Apparently not. Apparently you even hear me then. And the reason I share this is not only to say that I do think God hears us in those moments of grumbling, but more importantly, to show how I got something really wrong, to say that if we place all our desires for knownness, for deep committed friendship, if we place all those desires in one person, we might not have our hands open to receive all the good things that God has to give us through a whole network of people and in so many different ways. It seems so obvious to say it that I'm slightly embarrassed at my younger self's little episode. But as I say, amazingly, God is so gracious. I feel like he was kind of bantering with me a little bit back there. He does hear us and he does meet us in the moments when we forget it. So going back to good old Ruth and Naomi, Naomi is concerned for her friend. And so later on in the book, it's only four chapters long, so you should read it. I think it's brilliant. Naomi's concerned for her friend, so she takes a loving, active interest in her friend's romantic life, in the idea of marriage. We can't just kind of transpose this story into a 21st century context, but I think the principle of our romantic lives not being separate from our other relationships, but kind of held supportively, lovingly within this network of different relationships, I think that's a healthy thing that we can kind of see and exhibited in this relationship here. And I've been having a bit of a search around this week online, so my internet search history is quite interesting. And there's some really helpful stuff around. If this might be where some of you are at, and this might be what some of you would have wanted from a talk about this. HTB are developing some resources on dating well, which they're in the process of developing these. So I've kind of said what you Google, because there were these like really long URLs. If that's where you're at, these are some really helpful things about dating, and they've got lots more time to go into this than I have here. And if there are a few people who do listen to some of the talks that I've kind of pointed to up here, and if it's helpful to kind of get together and chat further, I genuinely don't know if that is a helpful thing or not. But if you think it is, then talk to other people. Let's see if there are a few people who would find that a useful thing. And this teaching is about having a healthy perspective, a godly perspective on dating, on making those relationships, on the way we date extraordinary and distinctive and good and godly. And one of the key things that's emphasised in these talks is dating out of a place of connection. Connection with God, connection with friends and family, connection with yourself. And then you're free to engage in meeting other people, which is, you know, all that dating is, with openness and with curiosity. So thinking, I wonder what this person is like, rather than, I wonder if this is the person I'm going to marry. There's this great Dutch speaker on these resources who talks about having your team, people that you trust to speak into your life so that they can encourage you and love you and support you and give you a kick in the pants every now and then if that's what you need. And I wonder if that we can be ready to be those sorts of friends to one another, to take seriously our friends, to love them deeply. I love in chapter 3, Naomi gives this advice to Ruth. She says, chapter 3, verse verse 3, she says, wash and perfume yourself, put on your best clothes, then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know that you're there until he's finished eating and eating and drinking. She's just kind of getting actively, lovingly involved in her friend's life, giving her a bit of encouragement. Now, let me be very clear. This is not the same as everybody having permission to speak into everybody else's life. A person has the right to choose who is on their team, just a few people who love them, who have this kind of sacrificial friendship going on, to invite those friends, and I really want to weight that word with all the biblical weight it can carry, maybe people want to invite just a few friends to speak into their lives about this particular aspect of their lives. This is about mutuality, it's about invitation, it's about friendship, not about everybody giving unwanted advice to everybody else. A church can be, and a number of you will know this, a church can be an extra scary place to be single, and can be an extra scary place to date, because it sometimes does feel a little bit public. But the model of Ruth and Naomi is not everybody piling in and getting on Ruth's case about Boaz, but in the context of this tender, mutually giving friendship, Naomi blesses and releases Ruth and supports her in that risky and unpredictable and scary thing of putting herself out there. So if you're not in that sacrificial mutual friendship with a person, give them some space. And if you are single and you think, actually, I wouldn't mind that. I wouldn't mind having a few people to just specifically speak into my life about this particular part of my life. That could feel like quite a vulnerable conversation to have, but maybe it's something that some people would find helpful. Now, I've talked quite a lot about extraordinary friendship, extraordinary relationship, and I do think that's absolutely key for this whole conversation. But I also said that we're called to lives of extraordinary faith. And again, that's true for all of us in all circumstances. But let me think a little bit about what that looks like in the context of thinking about singleness. And thinking of what it means to have a life of extraordinary faith in the complicated middle. Now, this book, the Book of Ruth, is not a book which describes a God to whom we see Ruth and Naomi faithfully putting in a time of prayer, and God then dutifully responding with the desired outcome. There is no formula to the extraordinary faith we see in this book. I think that's the point. Naomi and Ruth's faith looks a lot like life. Extraordinary faith looks a lot like living, like taking risks, like loving one another, like courage. This is one of those biblical books where we don't see God mentioned in every paragraph. In fact, he's mentioned very little. But it is incorporated into our scripture, into our canon. And I believe that's directed by the Holy Spirit, that it is in our big story. So why is it? Why is this book here if it's not mentioning God every 5 minutes? So I believe we are to see God in the sentences where we don't see him, if you see what I mean. We see Naomi's bitter and hard prayer. We see the moments of friendship, moments of hope, of disappointment, of relationship, of provision, of work, of fear, of risk, of courage. And we know that God is woven in there even when we don't see him. God is there in the shape and character of Boaz and Naomi, who have been shaped by God in his laws and in his ways, in his direction over years of life by being a part of his people. God is there in Ruth's decision to throw her lot in with him. God is there in the vulnerability of relationship that Ruth and Naomi have with each other, in the kindnesses, in the risks. So faith in the complicated middle, extraordinary faith, doesn't look like a formula. It looks like trusting God with our stories as they really are, in all of their complexity, and with our hearts. If we are in a place that we're dating, that means trusting God, being honest with him about how we're doing on that front, being trusting him with our dates, praying for our dates. If we're single for the time being, and that's a contented place to be, we're up for staying for that way right now. It's about our hearts being available for the fullness of all the relationships that God has for us. If we're single for the time being and not really up for staying that way, not really that content, it's about the extraordinary faith of trusting God for our emotional future. It is a step of really deep faith to say, Well, I do want to be married, but I trust that God can give me a rich and full life in a good marriage or outside of one. It takes real faith, extraordinary faith and courage, I believe, to hold on to that place in the middle. I'm hoping for this, but I'm trusting God for whatever comes. And I'm afraid that doesn't look like a formula. It doesn't look like pray this way and the spouse will turn up. It looks like a mixture of risk and courage and prayer and friendship and hope and honesty and open hands to receive the good gifts that God has for us all along the way. Not just the gift of a spouse, if that's what we're really praying for, but the gift of friends who know what meringues we like, and the gifts of really fun experiences along the way, even if, you know, dates don't go anywhere, really good encounters with people all the way along. I'm going to finish with this and take it or leave it. A while ago, I was having a bit of a phase where I was thinking and investing and praying quite a lot in sort of... I guess the structures of my life, my calling, where I would be living, really, you know, choosing to trust God with my money, all this kind of big stuff. And I suddenly realized that I hadn't really been talking to God, let alone choosing to trust him with my heart. I'd been talking to him a lot about these kind of this skeleton stuff, but I hadn't really been talking to him about my heart. And I felt led to pray through a series of psalms, and I started with Psalm 27, which I really love, and because it ends with a verse, there's one translation which says, be strong and let your heart take courage. I love that. And then every day for the next couple of weeks, I prayed through the subsequent psalms, so 28, 29, and so on, and I just asked God the question every day, what are you telling me about my heart? What do you want to say to me about my heart today? And for quite a long series of psalms, there's a little nugget about the heart in several of them. And I prayed through the psalm, and God really showed me that he cares about my future and where I live and money and all that stuff. But he also really does care about my heart. So I had this really great fortnight of conversation. And if some of you are thinking, actually, I would like to invite God into this area of my life a little bit more, and I don't really know how, I don't really know where to start, I offer that to you as a possible framework which may or may not be useful. Now, I've been really aware in thinking about this that so many of us are in so many different places about this situation. A number of you are married, some of you are single, and in all sort have different kind of responses to how that feels. But what I'm going to invite people to do is, because it can be a scary thing to come forward for prayer, what I'd like to invite people to do is that if you respond in any way to the sense of wanting to be a friend, the kind of friend that God has called you to be, would you come and just ask for someone to pray a brief prayer, I guess commissioning you to be that kind of friend, commissioning you to have an extraordinary friendship. If there's anything else you want prayer for as well, that is totally fine. But if you would like to pray to be commissioned as an extraordinary friend, then I invite you to do that.